August 20th, 2000, A Tale of Two Kingdoms, Part 36. This is Jeff Spittler. Okay. Okay, so I've got the, this is either good news or bad news, depending on your perspective. We're going to be taking a hiatus. Some of you know that the session had intended to start up a new class that will cover the Westminster Confession. I think Alan's going to be teaching that, as far as I know. And they were discussing this, so I guess they wanted to go back to a one-class thing for a while and do the confession. And I'm not sure what happened, but I guess Dave had to cover three or four chapters a week for the last 3 weeks to finish his class. I'm not even going to try. That new class will start 2 weeks from today, but next week I won't be here. So this will be actually our last class for the near future. Yay!
Part one,
yeah.
I suppose you're going to go worship an ashtray or something.
No, not this time. So, anyways, they'd asked me earlier about it, and I told them I'm traveling quite a bit this fall, so this seemed like a good time anyway. So, and since we've gotten at least as far as the Westminster Confession, this is probably as good a time to take a break as any. Okay, so if we weren't finishing up today, or pausing, it might be interesting to look at the Westminster documents, but we'll do that in the next class anyways. The terms on which they were received by the Scottish General Assembly, and also other documents published at the time like Lex Rex by Samuel Rutherford, some of the other controversies that were going on. But seeing as how we're trying to finish today, I thought we would just, I want to carry on with our chronological coverage so that we can get to the event that Mike's been waiting for all for 36 weeks here. Okay, let's see. Last week we reviewed what is known, or at least what I know about subscribing of the Solemn League and Covenant. Also went over two outcomes of the Solemn League and Covenant. First of all, the Westminster Assembly being tasked to write a directory of worship and a directory of church government. And this task, once undertaken, brought to the surface one of the great underlying tensions that had hitherto been submerged, or remained submerged, and that was the controversy between the Presbyterians and the Independents. Right, up until now, pretty much the Presbyterians and Independents were on, in essence, the same side, up to a point. And after this comes out, and especially since Episcopacy has pretty much been eliminated as a serious issue at this point, the tensions between the Presbyterians and Independents start to come out.
Is this Scotland only, or is this?
No, this is primarily England.
Primarily.
Right. In England, there are Presbyterians and Independents, but and supposedly on the Westminster Assembly, there's a lot more Presbyterians than Independents, but. And in Scotland, it's all Presbyterians. So. Okay. Then the other outcome of this, the Solemn League and Covenant, was the engagement of Scottish troops in the English Civil War. Right, this in turn helped turn the tide of the English Civil War, although not as dramatically as had been previously expected. But it also provided the impetus for a Scottish royalist uprising led by the Earl of Montrose. I say uprising, it wasn't too widespread. But for almost a year, or actually just over a year, with the support of Irish and Scottish Highlander troops, Montrose was able to win a series of lopsided victories and cause major casualties in every battle that he fought for about a year until he was finally defeated at Philiphaugh in September 1645. Okay, so that takes us up to the last week, or kind of to the middle of last week. So last week I did mention some of the cruelties of war perpetrated by the royalists. I think somebody asked me in the question session about the Covenanters, or I can't remember exactly how it came up, but I don't want to dwell on it, but the Covenant army did repay in kind when they finally had the opportunity. Well, you won't to be excited for Ray when you hear what they did. The Irish had fought on. Let's see, there were 300 Irish that fought on until 250 of them had fell, and their officers had been promised quarter. So this is James King Hewison's account of what happened afterwards. What follows is scarcely credible. The Irish soldiery were accompanied by their wives and children, and besides these were other women, army scullions and potboys, with probably the wounded to the number of 300. These were butchered like vermin in the courtyard of Newark Castle, which overlooks the Yarrow near the scene of battle. This must have been done with the concurrence of Argyll and the Council of War, Crawford, Lindsay, Buccleuch, Lauderdale, Lanark, Yester, Burgundy, Rutherford, Forrester, and William Scott. They watched the conflict throughout, and at noon dispatched the news of victory, declaring to the English commissioners at Berwick, "The Lord hath this day here at Philippon near Selkirk appeared gloriously for his people." His people had no pity in their savage breasts, forgetting that many of their own comrades had wives in the English and Irish camps. It may have been true what Patrick Gordon wrote concerning these Irish mercenaries. It seemed to them that there was no distinction betwixt a man and a beast, for they killed men ordinarily with no more feeling of compassion, and with the same careless neglect that they kill any hen or capon for their supper. And they were also, without all shame, most brutishly given to uncleanness and filthy lust. But he also asserts, of those two crying sins, the Scots were as guilty as they. It was the dying boast of Montrose that he always tried to stop unnecessary bloodshed, and if it was only a boast, the conduct of brutal ruffians from Ireland was no pattern for the saints of Covenant in Scotland. Nor was the massacre at Newark all. Leslie still further degraded his manhood by putting to death in cold blood the 50 heroes who stood by Adjutant Stewart. Those would be the 50 Irishmen who fought until most of them had been killed. And on his march to Edinburgh, by drowning at the bridge over the Avon near Linlithgow, 80 women and children, without sentence or the least formality of law, according to Sir George Mackenzie. O'Cahan and McLaughlin, these are Irish officers, were reserved for execution in Edinburgh. Nisbet, Rollo, and Alexander Ogilvy, a youth of 18, were beheaded in Glasgow. Guthrie tells the somewhat incredible story that when the poetic professor of divinity in the University of Glasgow, David Dixon, heard of these executions, he exclaimed, "The work goes bonnily on." I was reading John Buchan's, the biography of Montrose, last night, and he's also very hard on the Covenanters for doing this, because they basically couldn't be justified. He didn't think David Dixon had actually said that. He figured it was probably somebody else. So, what steeled the hearts of the Scots against the Irish was the fact that some of their officers were prominent actors in the 1641 massacres. Less refined ministers at the meeting of assembly in December, Cant and others, clamored for the blood of the captives and said the Lord was angry at the laws of the way. The old castle dungeons in St. Andrews held the victims safe. In St. Andrews, the estates assembled on 26 November, and the parish minister, Blair, opened with a bloodthirsty sermon. Warriston, lately returned from Westminster, adjured the members by their divine judge, and that sea of innocent blood which lay before his throne, crying for vengeance on these bloodthirsty rebels, the butchers of so many innocent souls, to steal their hearts and decree justice. He also trounced the runaway generals, attributed the pestilence and the massacre at Kilsyth to the discords of public men, and to malignancy, and asserted the Parliament was like to Noah's Ark, which had in it both foul and clean creatures. That would be the English Parliament. The Irish prisoners were ordered to be executed without trial. I don't have a lot to say about that. I mean, I don't think that you can justify the Covenant army in doing everything that they did there. I mean, there's reasons why they acted that way, but they can't. As I think John Buchan was saying, even if the Irish did such and such, the Scots could hardly claim to not have, not be, could hardly justify it biblically to do that.
One question, maybe you can't answer either. How far, is there any indication of how far up the chain of command approval for this went?
According to what I just read, it went all the way to the very top.
All the way to the very top. So they must have. I wonder if there is if there's a theological flaw here that someday ought to be uncovered. Because they must have thought then. These people were thinking then, or maybe we have a theological flaw. They must have justified it biblically. I mean, they must have thought that what they were doing could be justified.
That's an interesting question. I don't have a good answer for it in terms of finding any sort of contemporary writing or anything that would justify it. So,
yeah.
But I mean, some things I think would be very hard to justify. If you give in a battle, you give someone a quarter, saying surrender, and you know, and then you go out late, you know, and give them a quarter, make, in other words, make them prisoner of war, and then you go execute them. That
I don't think.
I mean, there's some things I just find very hard to believe. So.
Of course, do you have the same problems with what David did? Do you find that David was not justified in killing man, woman, and child so many times?
Well, perhaps. No, but I mean, what God told him to do it, then that's...
Well, what are these folks saying? God cries out in his word. Take vengeance upon himself.
Yeah, see, I think that'd be hard. Well...
And I don't recall God ever telling David to do these raids, kill man, woman, and child. I just don't recall him saying God told him to do that.
Yeah, well...
Yeah, but I don't think... I mean, if you look at that whole account of Ziklag and his deception and the whole thing through there, it's not at all clear that God's blessing was on him.
No, I didn't know.
I just said, because he had problems with that. Because he said that
yeah,
he
but
yeah. I mean, when you read the biblical account, I think you have to justify what David did there.
But I'm not justifying. I'm just saying, do you have a problem with that?
What do you mean a problem?
Well,
if David...
We need to get back on track. But Rob was trying to get a point in. So go ahead, Rob.
One point to remember with David is that he was restricted from building the temple because he was a man of war. Because he shed so much blood. So it wasn't totally approved, or he would have been allowed to build the temple, I would say.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. But furthermore, I think this is obviously this is definitely a broader issue than right?
But, oh, we can deal with it. What is this problem?
So, I mean, I think Rob makes a very good point, but and that I also agree with Dan that, again, it's just cases where you would have to sort of read into it to say David's conduct was actually approved. You know, so, in every case. So, but having said that, we'd discuss that later. But I still think even you're going to have a very hard time justifying, you know, say the offer of quarter and then going back on it. You know.
Well, there's a parallel there. Did he not, in this case, the Philistines and things like that? Wasn't David acting to be their big buddy and then going through?
Yeah.
Another
yeah. No. That I do. Yeah. That's what I think. That's what the problem was. Rob, sorry.
I don't know if it was a special situation for David or not, but I do know that there are other precedents in the Bible that we can look at, like when the Syrians came down to Elijah, and they were all struck blind, and he took them into Samaria, and Ahab said, "Should we put them to death?" He said, "No, clothe them and feed them and send them back. If you captured them at war, would you put them to death?" So, actual prisoners were not to be treated that way. Not those who have been given quarter, at least, according to that precedent.
Yeah, I think that's a good counter example.
Meanwhile,
back in Scotland. Yeah, okay. It's a very interesting point, but I. Thank you, Simon. Meanwhile, back in Scotland. Let's see, we've gotten through the first 150th of this week's material now. Let's see. I'll skip a little bit here. Okay, the General Assembly met in May of 1647, and they disciplined ministers who had signed a royalist bond, specifically ones who had been sympathetic to Montrose's uprising. I hadn't discussed it before, but there was some kind of royalist bond that was promulgated, and some ministers had signed it. Montrose himself escaped Philiphaugh. He rode north into the Highlands, and in November 1646, he slipped away disguised as the servant to a minister, and went out to took a Norwegian vessel to the continent, where he spent four years. He initially tried to organize some further action for the king, but actually was to no avail until until after Charles I was dead, and then he was involved in some military action for Charles II. Okay, so by the spring of 1646, things were starting to look pretty bleak for Charles. He lost a major battle at Naseby. Simon nods yes, so giving the official royal seal of approval of pronunciation. At that battle, the king escaped. His correspondence with the queen had been captured, and when it came out that he had been trying to bring foreign troops and papist troops over, and that was kind of a public relations blow. So, I mean, even people who had been pretty sympathetic to the king when they saw he was, you know, trying to do this, he, you know, lost credibility. In September 1645, Bristol had been lost by the royalists. Interestingly enough, in both the Bristol and Naseby battles, Cromwell had sent back reports playing up the contributions of the independents. In Parliament, when they reprinted his reports, they left out the propaganda part, but then some independents went and printed the whole report anyways, just causing more contention. A number of royalist strongholds fell in the fall and winter. The city of Chester, which would have been key if the king wanted to bring in further Irish reinforcements, surrendered on the 30th of January, 1646. Let's see, all his efforts at getting help from Spain, France, and the Pope all failed. Let's see, Christopher Hibbert, writing in this history of the English Civil War, Cavaliers and Roundheads of the English Civil War, 1642 to 1649, said, the king's schemes never worked out as he planned they should, since it was a sad, inescapable fact that his promises were not believed anymore, either in the country or outside it. He was not trusted to stand by his word, even if he had the power and means to do what he promised to do. He was judged to be even more deceitful than most monarchs were. On the 21st of March, 1646, the last royalist army still in the field was defeated near Stow-on-the-Wold. A number of royalist-held castles remained, but the First English Civil War was pretty much over at that point, from a military standpoint. The king, with little other hope left over, decided to go to the Covenanter army. Might strike you as strange. Let me just, this is again from Hibbert, a little explanation of what the king was thinking. Without an army left to fight for him in England, Charles turned for help to the Scots. He knew that the Scottish Covenanters felt themselves ill-used by the English Parliament, which had been thankful enough to enlist their help when the Royalists seemed likely to triumph, but which now seemed as ready to neglect the unpaid Scottish army as to go back upon the undertakings about Presbyterianism and the other promises contained in the Solemn League and Covenant. If Charles could play on this dissatisfaction, if he could aggravate Scottish fears of the growing influence of the independents in the English Parliamentary army, if he could arouse their sympathy for one who was, after all, a Scottish king and persuade them to agree to defend his interests against his rebellious English subjects, he might yet retrieve his fortunes. So, with that in mind, I mean, he really, I suppose, didn't have much, you know, there were very few choices left open to him at this time. I suppose he could have, you know, the other possibility would have been he could have tried to flee the country. Let's see. Okay, so he arrived at the Scottish army, which was then headquartered in the East Midlands between Nottingham and Newark on the 6th of May. For about 8 months, the Covenanters tried to convince him to agree to the Solemn League and Covenant. And they had a lot of ministers come in. He generally debated, kept his demeanor. A few times he got angry, I guess. But for the most part, he just, you know, agreed to disagree, wouldn't change his mind. And this is again a quote from Hibbert. Normally, however, the king reserved his complaints for his wife. This is about the fact that he hadn't complained too much, he'd been courteous and so on. And in the letters that he managed to send her, he told her that he had never known what it was to be barbarously baited before. The only comfort he had left was in her love and in his own clear conscience. The queen had little sympathy with his tiresome conscience. Any promises he gave need not be permanently binding. She agreed with Lord Jermyn. Surely it was better in the end to be a Presbyterian king than no sort of king at all. It was not as if he were a Catholic. But the king would not give away. His clear conscience would not let him abandon the church which he loved, and even now there might be hope. Admittedly, the news from England continued to be bad. The few towns that remained in royalist hands were all falling fast. Only a few scattered strongholds were left. And he had been headquartered to Oxford, and towards the end of June, the storekeeper at Oxford announced he had provisions for 12 more days, and the supplies of powder were all but exhausted. And in fact, I guess they capitulated on the 20th of June. But again, as you know, mentioned before, if Pharaoh had just let the Israelites go, he would have saved himself an awful lot of trouble. So. Okay, so he remained steadfastly obstinate in his refusal to compromise. And in the end, the Scots agreed to hand him over to the English Parliament. Okay, in return, the Parliament paid them the money that was owed, or at least a substantial part of it, and handed over the king on the 3rd of February 1647 and returned to Scotland. And this did later open them up to charges that they had sold their king. I'm not sure exactly if this is supposed to rhyme, but it goes something like, the traitor Scott sold his king for a groat. Or it looks like groat, I don't know. Groat, yeah. Okay, well then if we're going to make it rhyme, then we'd have to say that the traitor Scott, but maybe it's not meant to rhyme. What is it?
A coin.
A coin, okay. Okay, well, in November of 1647, he managed to escape from where he was being held in England and fled to Carisbrook Castle, which is on the Isle of Wight. And on the 26th of December, he met, well, I'm not sure how long he met with them, but he met with several of the Scots nobility representing approximately the Hamilton family. They worked out an agreement called the Engagement. Okay, the terms are that the king would have both the English and Scottish parliaments affirm the solemn league and covenant, and providing that none who is unwilling shall be constrained to take it, was exact wording. Now, both parliaments have already approved it, but presumably this means that the parliaments would approve it and the king would sign it as an official act rather than an ordinance. The king was to establish Presbyterian church government in England for 3 years. He would continue the Westminster Assembly, and at the end of 3 years, with consultation from the Assembly, the king and the parliament would determine how to establish church government. The king would suppress the opinions and practices of anti-Trinitarians, Anabaptists, Antinomians, Arminians, Familists, Brownists, Separatists, Independents, Libertines, and Seekers. That's actually a quote in terms of who he would actually suppress. And Seekers, apparently the sect that Oliver Cromwell was part of. Okay, now, the king would do all this, but what would the Scots do? Well, the Scots army would return him to power. So after negotiating this treaty, a convention of states met in Edinburgh on the 2nd of March, and after some debate in June of 1648, they passed acts which basically approved of the engagement and started putting the country back on a war footing. So now they're going to go to war against England, or against the English Parliament. This was strongly resisted by a significant part of the church, Gillespie Rutherford et al., and it was condemned by the General Assembly meeting in July of 1648. It was condemned because the engagement, while condemning independency, never spoke of episcopacy at all. It was caused a breach between England and Scotland, and it trespassed on the liberties of the church. And I haven't actually seen the act of the General Assembly, but you might note that the engagement is somewhat Erastian in nature, and that it still has the king and the parliament specifying the form of church government. Okay. This General Assembly also approved the Westminster Larger and Shorter Catechisms. Okay, let's see. While the General Assembly was meeting, the Duke of Hamilton crossed the border with an army of 10,500 infantry and cavalry. He was joined by 3,600 English soldiers, leftover royalists, apparently. Cromwell led an army of 8,000 and soundly defeated the engagers on the 17th to 20th of August, 1648, at Preston Moor on the River Ribble. That was 352 years ago today. They were fighting. And it was a very poorly run operation on the Scots side. Apparently the way they set up their forces, Cromwell was allowed to take one part at a time. And he took 10,000 prisoners, so, yeah. If they were pressed men, been forced into this, they were allowed to return home, on promising never to fight in England without permission of the Parliament. And the volunteers were sent to plantations as slaves or to Venice as soldiers. Some of the officers were remained in prison. In fact, Hamilton was later executed. Okay, with the news of the defeat, Argyll, who had opposed the engagement, and his supporters formed a new government. A group of Covenanters in the Western Lowlands marched to Edinburgh and seized the castle of Edinburgh in the so-called Whigamore's Raid. Have you ever heard the term Whig? W-H-I-G? Well, this is where it originates from. Not the Whigamore's Raid, but the fact some of the Covenanters were referred to as Whigs. And the exact origin of that is unclear, but the meaning of Whig later changed some, but for a while it meant basically people who were opposed to the crown. Cromwell then proceeded on to Edinburgh and arrived on the 4th of October. he met with Argyle, Worst, and 11 other leaders, they being anti-engagers, or against the engagement, and thereby standing for continued solidarity with English Parliament. The meeting was fairly happy. It wasn't he may have come in with his army, but it wasn't on a war footing. Okay. Well, in January 1649, the news of the engagement having come out, Scotland now having sent an army into England, the English Parliament had a bit different attitude towards the king. They established a High Court of Justice to try Charles. They passed three resolutions, quote, to this effect. The people are under God, the original Valgus power. The commons wield that supreme power. The laws enacted by the commons and parliament bind all citizens alike. This is James King Ewison. Here was the fruit of the teaching of the Scots jurisprudence, Buchanan and Rutherford, growing on English soil. Okay, Charles was impeached as being a tyrant, traitor, murderer, and a public implacable enemy of the Commonwealth of England. I think this started on the 4th of January, and by the 30th, he'd been pronounced guilty, sentenced, and beheaded on the 30th of January. We're running low on time, so I was going to read a little bit on Charles by Hewison that sort of summarizes his life, but I mean the sort of themes we've been at again and again with him always lying, taking sort of the Stuart attitude from his father, being an absolute monarch, and all these things, just, he never, and presumably God hardened his heart, he never was able to compromise at the right time. He always compromised too late. And in any case, I finally ended up with him being executed. So within a week of that, the Scottish Chancellor, Loudon, surrounded by members of Parliament, marched to the Cross of Edinburgh and issued a proclamation that Charles II was now King of Great Britain, France, and Ireland. And when they formulated a statute later that year, it was contingent on Charles II accepting the two covenants, so the National Covenant and the Solemn Leaguing Covenant, the Westminster Standards, Presbyterial Church Government, and removing Montrose from his presence. Mike.
Didn't it seem a bit strange to you that Charles II, son of Charles II?
Yes.
So they whacked an old man, and then they did.
Well, the Scots didn't approve of executing him. Generally, now I should make it very clear here that not all the Covenanters supported bringing Charles II over. But you have to remember that the Covenanters, broadly used, had a wide variety of opinions. So a lot of them were, say, much more moderate or whatever than say Rutherford and Gillespie. So. But a lot of the Scots, again, they maintained this attitude towards the monarchy that we just find very hard to understand.
Also, it wasn't a normal Parliament that executed. I mean, they really kind of chickened out when it took the monarch. It was kind of an ad hoc group of men.
Well, the Parliament had appointed this High Court of Justice, so. And that they're the ones that actually...
Whacking.
Yeah. Yeah, so...
What's
the answer? I don't know. special prosecutor, okay. The Duke of Hamilton had been captured at Preston Moor. He was also tried by the High Court of Justice because he was technically an English citizen, having been created the Earl of Cambridge by Charles previously. He was found guilty of levying war to assist the king against the kingdom and people of England, and had committed murders, outrages, rapings, waste, and spoils upon the said people, and he was beheaded too. The Duke of Hamilton, he'd been the leader of the engagement party.
Montrose.
Yeah. Montrose, well, we'll get to that in a minute. In January 1649, the same month that Charles was executed, the Scots Parliament passed acts condemning the engagement, and they passed the Act of Classes, called the Act of Classes, as it divided people who had supported the engagement into classes, four classes, and they were banished from public office for varying lengths. So the first class were those banished for life, the sort of worst participants, ones who'd also, aided Montrose and so on. That actually removed a lot of the... some nobility from the higher level of, the Scottish, like Privy Council and so on, and various offices, like the treasurer and so on. They didn't receive the life sentence. They had to publicly repent before they could be returned to office. Okay, so I want to make sure I got to where Mike wanted us to get to before the end of class, and we've done that. This is probably as good as any place to take sort of a hiatus. Very shortly, the Covenanters would begin negotiations with Charles II. Eventually, some, but not all, were, in the words of the Who, fooled again. And, you know, this again, it's just one of these things that... But, you know, it's hard for us to understand, but sort of an underlying belief that just caused a lot of problems later on. Okay, what my plan was, I had the four sort of issues that I wanted to mention briefly, things that we've sort of uncovered, but then in the upcoming years, past 1649, are become important. And then I was going to try to give a very quick sketch, and given the time, it'll have to be a very quick sketch of Scottish church history after 1649. Let's see, the issues, the things that have come out that sort of continue on are, first of all, the Solemn League and Covenant is disdained by the king. Okay, Charles I had, you know, outright said it was treason to sign it. Charles II, being a, you know, accomplished liar like his father, later, you know, signed the covenant and then killed people for adhering to it. Let's see, it was also understood differently by the Parliament. I mean, I think it was pretty clear they signed it under some duress. I'm sure some of them were sincere, but some were not sincere. When Oliver Cromwell rises to power, he eventually enforces his understanding on the Scots. If we get to the little sketch of church history, we'll try to get to that. This hasn't come out so much, but it does, I think, comes out again and again in Presbyterian history, and that's this whole idea of Christian charity, is one way of putting it. So disagreements among Christians often, I might say, remain submerged when they're on the weak and powerless side. So, for instance, the Independents and the Presbyterians were willing to pretty much ignore their differences and make common cause against the king. But amongst Presbyterians, those disagreements may not even remain surged even when they are being persecuted. So even when the persecution was hottest, the Covenanters had a hard time exercising Christian charity towards one another or towards the various factions. You know, and if, assuming we come back to this sometime and you're in the class, the, eventually you'll see that even when they were being persecuted and they were preaching out in the fields, that some field preachers didn't get along with other field preachers, and because of issues like how much they could associate with preachers who had taken an indulgence, you know, and compromised their principles. So it's
they need a promise keeper for unity.
I think it's a common temptation to when you disagree with someone theologically, you know, to also, you know, get at odds with them and stop exercising charity towards them and so on. It comes out again and again. And maybe it's partly a Scottish tendency. I don't know, but. This concept of monarchy, the idea that the king was the Lord's anointed, stayed pretty well entrenched. In retrospect, it seems a lot of their problems were exacerbated by holding this idea. I think generally our leaders are God's judgment. there might still be something to that, though, in terms of respecting that, even though our leaders are wicked, you know, respecting that it is our ministers of God, even if they're ministers of his wrath against us. So sometimes we complain a lot, and maybe we should, you know, be looking around besides just at the leader. Anyways, and then also this idea is Christ being head of the church, right? The Covenanters ultimately maintained this truth at the cost of their lives. It was certainly antithetical to the Stuart monarchs who wanted to be the head of everything. I guess one other issue that might come up, this is certainly off the wall idea from Covenanter history, most historians you read, but John Buchan actually, who's certainly a very moderate sort of individual, tended to think that, I forget exactly how he put it, but that the persecution that the Scots faith might have been partly payback for some of the atrocities that they did when they were fighting against the royalists and so on. So I'm not claiming that's the case, but certainly that is interesting that, you know, we tend to whitewash some of the things that they did do. And hard to say. There's consequences for things in history. Okay, so let me give you the... I guess we can go on and on since we're in this room today.
Yeah.
We don't get interrupted. I imagine eventually someone will come looking for us. Let's see. Okay, after... I'm going to give this basically just from memory. After the... after Cromwell visited Edinburgh for the next couple of years, things were fine in Scotland. The church had a lot of influence in the civil government and so on. But in a couple of years later, the Scots anoint Charles II, okay, as king, based on his adherence to the covenants. Even though some covenanters make it very clear that, look, he's just taking these covenants, you know, he'll do anything to get in power. I mean, it's by no means were they all fooled, but some were. And Montrose actually comes with an army to fight. He's captured then, and he'd already been condemned on treason, so he's executed. Charles II escapes back to France, where I don't think he returned again until 1660. But for the next, Cromwell comes and fights with the Scots again, defeats them. And after that, he enforced a number of restrictions on them. And again, I'm going from memory here, but I think I don't think the General Assembly met during that time. A number of restrictions placed on the church, and certainly in England, the Presbyterian cause was completely lost at that point. It's not clear that it was ever won, but it was certainly lost at that point. Well, Cromwell dies, his son takes over. Well, Cromwell becomes a dictator, basically. He dismisses Parliament. He rules over England. His son takes over after he dies. His son eventually abdicates, leaves. I forget the exact, he wasn't overthrown, but basically Charles II is invited back and is crowned king over England and Scotland, and I guess Wales and Ireland. And after that, the persecution begins for the next 28 years, from 1660 to 1688. At various times, I mean, Charles basically, of course, completely, almost immediately goes right back on his pledge to uphold the covenants. In fact, kills people for adhering to them. The Parliament in Scotland, with a lot of influence of Charles, passes a number of oppressive acts. Eventually, the Christians are forced to meet in the field, in conventicles, and those are banned and considered to be seditious. Certainly, even Cromwell had an idea of toleration, which is why the Presbyterians they weren't persecuted while he was, in that sense. They maybe weren't allowed to have their form of church government and so on, but exactly the same. But Cromwell did maintain this idea of toleration. But, of course, Charles II had no such idea. And for 28 years, in varying degrees, the church was persecuted. Thousands were killed or banished, captured in war, treated very inhumanely. They at times, these are things that parts that we'd really like to cover in our next class, next time we start meeting. They go to war, self-defensive war, but they never muster enough troops to make any kind of serious challenge. It's always a sort of militia type of activity. Because they lost control of the Scottish government, they never got to the point where they could form a serious army. They are chased and hunted down and killed. Sometimes it's very hot. Sometimes the government brings troops of Highlanders to come plunder various parts of Scotland and so on. Finally, in 1688, Charles II dies. His brother James II becomes king. James II is a Catholic. And that causes a lot of worry, and I think actually he produced a son, as I recall, so this possibility of a Catholic monarchy, reigning. So with that, basically the people overthrow the king. Some people say he just abdicated, but William of Orange, was invited back, came back, and James II fled. There was one battle, the Battle of Boyne in Northern Ireland, that you know, naval bat, or at least at a port with the ships and so on. Losing that, he ended up back, I think, in France, lived out his days. When William and Mary came to power in 1688, Presbyterianism was reestablished as official religion of Scotland. It wasn't completely satisfactory to all of the Covenanters. I guess for several reasons, which I may not be able to remember all of them at the moment. Basically, they're still being, in a sense, William is still acting as if he's the head of the church, even if he's a benevolent one. They've still reneged on the Solemn League and Covenant because Presbyterianism is not established in England. And so some of the Covenanters actually stay out of the revolution. This is called the Glorious Revolution when William takes over. Some Covenanters stay out of the Revolution Settlement Church that comes out of that, and those Covenanters basically meet in societies. It's a very small number of people. It's from those that we actually trace our heritage as Covenanters. So, yes. So it's a very long story, interesting story. The interesting, I think, in terms of length is the book by James King Hewison called The Covenanters, which is a history of roughly the same time period, is two volumes. This is the first volume. This is how far we've covered. We've covered right to the end of this volume here. So he's got a whole other volume about the rest of it. I don't know if that means it will take another 36 weeks to finish the class. But in any case, that's it. So I think we better quit quickly. Next week, if you want, you can just have a discussion section without me. Instead of going to Mr. Carroll's class. Or you can point Mike to be the chair of the chair of the discussion section. So, I think we better stop there.